Albert Einstein once said, "If you can't explain it to a six-year-old, you don't understand it yourself." Sometimes technology makes us feel like six-year-olds, especially when hackers try to use the internet to steal something from each of us. If you think you have nothing of value to a hacker, think again. You and everyone you know are exactly who hackers target every day. This is DIY Cyber Guy with David W. Schroefer. Every week, he will show you how cybersecurity can be as easy as locking up your house at night. Now, here is your host, David W. Schroefer.
Welcome to DIY Cyber Guy, the show that helps you understand what is happening out there on the internet and gives you simple tips to do something about it. We have cause to celebrate today. Net neutrality's defense took a huge step forward this week thanks to Washington State, and we're going to tell you all about that. So because we have cause to celebrate, I'm going to give away a full copy of my book, Digital Habits, for 1 week. Today is Thursday, March 8th. Everyone who subscribes to our list at DIYCyberGuy.com/free between now and March 15th will get an electronic copy of my entire book, Digital Habits, 5 Simple Tips to Help Keep You and Your Information Safe Online. Seriously, until now, my ebook has been one chapter of my book, but for 1 week, it will be all 6 chapters and the glossary at the end. And if I gave away 10,000 copies or more this week, I will extend it by another week. So, tell anyone you know who wants free, easy tips to stay safe online, just go to DIYCyberGuy.com/free. Again, that's DIYCyberGuy.com/free. Spread the word. So, this week we're going to talk about the new law in Washington State and why there's cause for celebration. We're going to talk to Dr. Dale Meyer-Rose, a retired Major General from the U.S. Air Force, Will Maxson, who is an Assistant Director at the FTC, and the title of our show is Bitcoin Dead? It's not dead yet, and it's not going to be if quantum computing goes the way that we think it will, and we're going to talk more about that in our last segment. That's a lot to get to, so let's get started. First and foremost, Washington State this week became the first state to pass a law requiring net neutrality back into place. And that's over the rules set by the FCC back in December. And I think this is great. This is a great move. It's rational, it's smart, it's fair, and it's consistent with the purpose behind the internet, which is to let you get to any site you can find, as long as you're not breaking the law, of course. Now, speaking of breaking the law, the Washington state law is actually in violation of the FCC law that was passed last December, because the FCC's law actually prohibits states from making their own rules as in regards to net neutrality. So this may actually play out in court before Washington state's law goes into effect on June 6th of 2018. But Washington state is taking the right move. They're joining about 30 states who are engaging in some activity to reenact net neutrality in their states. But Washington state took the right move by passing a law that will basically require the FCC to take them on head on to challenge the concept that the FCC can pass a law prohibiting the states from doing anything they want to do. So that's why I feel like celebrating. That's why I'm giving away my book for free until March 15th. So I could spend 5 episodes on net neutrality, but here's the bottom line. I do not think the internet is a right. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, those are examples of human rights. But the internet is not on that list. Why? Because this stuff costs money, lots of money. If you've ever been to a network data center with its hundreds of rows of computer equipment stacked up in vertical racks, knowing that one of these computer racks and one computer on one of these racks, which is just a few inches high in most cases, can cost anywhere from a few $1,000s to over $1 million, depending on its function. Then add that to the massive cost associated with operating the center, the climate control, the redundant power supply, the uncountable number of network cables throughout the facility, all the people it takes to run that facility. And when you type www.something.com, your request goes through a few of these facilities before it ends up on the server that runs the website you want. And these are not government entities or nonprofits building these big centers. These are mostly run by for-profit companies. So the internet has real cost, and no company would bear those costs unless they were paid. but we do pay. So when you sign up with an internet service provider, you're paying for the cost of the internet. When your favorite website puts computers online to support their website, they're paying for the cost of the internet. When you pay your data plan on your mobile phone, you're paying for the cost of the internet. These are all dollars that go to the companies that run these massive centers and these massive fiber optic pipes that run between these centers that move your information around and make the internet what we've come to know it as today. So the internet has real costs, and we pay for those costs. What the internet service providers can't do, in my humble opinion, is pick favorites. They can't give more access or faster access to one site over another site. It can't be priced like cable systems where you pay for access to bundles of sites but have to pay more access to other sites, because that limits your accessibility to one site over another, and they would get to choose in that example. So internet service providers can't speed up or slow down the information you're getting based on the website you're getting it from, or they shouldn't be able to. Of course, the FCC rules that they voted in December of 2017 do give the internet service providers the right to do that. Washington State's law overturns that. So once you've paid for internet access, in my opinion, you should be able to simply go where you want to go and do what you want to do, as long as you're not committing a crime. And there are lots of crimes you can commit online, but that's another story. So it should operate, the internet should operate just like a telephone. If you know the number, you should be able to connect that call, just like the next guy in the next room, in the next house, in the next building who also wants to connect a call. It should connect just as fast and just as reliably as anybody else. No preferential treatment. So here's what the governor of Washington State said this week. And I'm quoting, internet service providers otherwise could limit what websites or apps you would be able to use. They could slow down your use and access unless you use their preferred apps or their chosen services. We are here to say Washingtonians will be protected from throttling from fast lines, and they will be protected in preserving an open and accessible internet. That was Washington Governor Jay Inslee, a Democrat, after he signed the law into effect on Monday. Again, the problem is that the new FCC rules passed last December preempt states from making their own net neutrality rules. So the state of Washington is challenging the FCC's power to prevent states from making their own rules, which is why this is probably going to play out in court before the Washington state laws go into effect on June 6th. As of today, there are about 30 states taking some kind of action or multiple actions against the FCC's net neutrality rules. And in the show notes, we have a list of all of them, exactly what states, what rules, what resolutions, state by state, including those states that have done nothing at all. So hats off to Washington State and the 29 other states taking on the FCC in their terrible decision on net neutrality. And if you want to write your congressman or your governor, if you're on the one of the states that is doing nothing at all yet, feel free to do so. Again, go to DIYCyberGuy.com for a list of the show notes of this episode, and we'll give you a complete list of every single state. We'll be right back with our first guest after this.
Get the news on our shows and other happenings by following us on Twitter. Find us at VoiceAmericaTRN or Twitter.com/VoiceAmericaTRN.
Anchor ID is a new way to log into websites and mobile apps, all without a password. The key is your smartphone, literally. Your smartphone is the key that will replace the need for passwords to your online sites. Our next product will be available to Salesforce.com users soon. To sign up for the first year free, just go to anchorid.com/Salesforce. Visit anchorid.com/Salesforce and get your first year free.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
You are listening to DIY Cyber Guy with David W. Schroefer. If you have a question for David, please send it to questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. That's questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back to DIY Cyber Guy. We have a guest, Will Maxson, who's been on the show before. Will is the assistant director of the Federal Trade Commission's Division of Marketing Practices. And prior to joining the FTC, Will worked as a law clerk for the Honorable Danny Reeves of the U.S. District Court of the Eastern District of Kentucky. He also served as an associate at Jones Day and Wiley Ryan LLP. He graduated cum laude from Vanderbilt University, and he received his law degree from the University of Michigan Law School. Welcome back, Will.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being back on the show. I'd like to talk about adware and some of the things that can do to listeners' computers. Is it true, or rather, we've told listeners in the past that all you have to do to get infected by a website is to visit the website. You don't have to give a credit card number necessarily, although that's bad too if it's a malicious site. You don't have to even click anything within the site. Just visiting the site itself is enough to infect your computer with malware if that is the intent of the website. How does adware play into that?
So with adware and malicious ads, what can often happen is what we sometimes call like a drive-by download, which would be if you go to visit a website, and the website itself might be completely innocuous, but many websites obviously will sell space on their website to ad providers, and within those ads, there could be malicious code that could download an unwanted program onto your computer, could download a malicious program, it could be collecting information and reporting information. It could even utilize parts of your processing power in your computer for a part of, say, a bot network or something like that. Because, you know, the ads that come through on each web page, it's running code, computer code, just like any other website. So if just one ad is bad on a website, you can have a problem even if the website itself is completely legitimate.
Now, when you talk about drive-by downloads, there are degrees, right? You mentioned botnets. I've told our listeners in the past about some cryptocurrency code where the ad itself is actually turning your computer into a Bitcoin miner or a Monero miner while you're visiting that website. But those are types of examples that are less invasive than some of the more extreme cases of malware. So one of the things that this drive-by downloads can do is, I think, something you mentioned in our last interview, which is pop-up screens saying, hey, we've identified a problem. Can you call this 800 number? Is that what you've been seeing?
Yes, we do see. We have seen pop-up for tech support scams where, you know, you're using your computer and everything seems normal, then all of a sudden a blue pop-up or red pop-up or whatever will come onto your screen and tell you that there's some fatal error in your computer or some huge problem and you need to call a certain number to get it fixed. And then if you call in, you end up you're calling a tech support scammer who's trying to trick you into thinking your computer is messed up and have you pay hundreds of dollars for tech support services you don't need. And those can work through ads, because within an ad that might get delivered, there could be, you know, what would be called an exploit kit, which would, this little bit of software could give a hacker essentially certain access to your computer to control different things, like making it do a pop-up. It can be used for ransomware, where it might lock up your entire machine and tell you, you know, you have to pay a certain amount of Bitcoin or it's going to delete all the files. It can display other ads that you aren't wanting to see all the time. You know, it can do whatever it wants to do. And one of the ways it can come into your computer is through a bad ad.
So let's talk about that, I think, in a little more depth. The pop-ups in particular. So to get you to install one of these more insidious pieces of malware, it's got to get your permission, right? So one of the things that is that I've seen personally on my computer is a pop-up that says, hey, it's time to update your Adobe product, if you have Adobe Acrobat on your computer or something like that, or click here to run your latest update. And I very strongly advise listeners not to ever click that pop-up because it might be malware. So is that that's one of the things you're seeing a lot of being delivered by some of these adware scripts or just malicious websites?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on your operating system and the browser you're using as to whether you're going to need to click to give permissions for certain bad software to come onto your machine. And if you do, the exploit, the bad software might try to change the text to trick you into clicking it. It might hide the text behind another pop-up and sort of try to click you into hitting OK or download when you don't actually see what the text is really telling you about what's happening. They'll do whatever they can to try to convince you to give the program the control it needs to send you ads, to take money from you, to use ransomware, anything that they want to do with the computer. It's going to be coming through that download of the original bad software that you got.
And you mentioned that different systems will require different levels of permission. So more secure systems would require you to click more yes buttons effectively along the way as you're installing bad software, which means the bad guys have to trick you more, and a more open software product would not have as many protections. Have you seen evidence that some systems are better than others? Like, is Microsoft better than Apple or vice versa, or are certain browsers better than others from this perspective?
We haven't examined different types of browsers to see which might protect better than others. I know there's other publications and third-party companies that evaluate browsers. But one of the things that we tell people, regardless of what browser you're using or what operating system, is to make sure that you're downloading your software updates as often as possible, because these exploits will come up, and frequently the software that's being exploited, whether it's Adobe or your browser or whatever it is, they'll discover it and they'll come up with some code to fix it. But your system, won't implement that fix unless you've downloaded the updates for your software.
Yeah, and on this show we've been talking about things like Spectre and Meltdown for several weeks now, and the number one way to stay on top of those vulnerabilities is exactly that, is keeping on top of your updates, both for the operating system that you're using, also for the browsers that you're using. So thanks for reinforcing that advice. I think that's really important. You also mentioned the idea of hiding text behind other text. Now, is this a type of a form fill hack where you're not either agreeing to what you think you're agreeing to when you're clicking a link on a website, or if there's other information that they're trying to hide from you? What did you mean by the hiding the text portion of that?
So what it might do is, for instance, if it's trying to download or run something or obtain permissions from your system to take certain control of your computer that would normally require you to okay it, your system may automatically, give you the pop-up dialog box to decide whether to okay that download or those permissions. And if the bad software is good enough, it knows that's going to happen, and so it sometimes will throw up a pop-up window that covers up the text of the underlying box. It'll, leave the OK button visible so you can still click that, but the pop-up will try to cover the text that that you would need to see to find out what you're clicking on. Things like that to try to manipulate people into giving permissions or OKing things that normally they wouldn't do.
So the box that you can read on your monitor is saying, click here to, pick your command, but something innocuous or something that you may want to do, where in fact that the real message is invisible to you because it's being hidden by the code. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it might be hidden by another pop-up that's literally on top of the one below it. position in such a way that you can still hit the OK button to continue. It's just the pop-up is actually covering the text of that message.
And have you seen, is that one of the more prevalent types of things, or really what is the most prevalent or really the most malicious type of adware that that the FTC has seen?
We've certainly seen it all. I mean, we've mentioned the tech support pop-ups that lead to people losing, you know, in many cases, hundreds of dollars to a tech support scam. Sometimes you'd see ransomware that would come through that same way that, you know, could cause a significant amount of loss or loss of files. You can have less insidious but still annoying things like adware that is designed to send you pop-up just advertisements more often, or to inject advertisements into the toolbars of your browser to send you to certain websites. They can have, you know, and can also be used, you know, as bots to harness your computing power to help a bot network. I mean, once they've got an exploit kit to give them an exploit into your computer, they can use it for really whatever they want, and it might change as long as they have that open exploit where they've got the bad software that's allowing them to have some control over the system. They might run ads for a while, then they might transfer and sell that exploit to a tech support scammer, and they might run a tech support scam on your system. They can use it as long as it's there. So the best defense, like I said, to avoid that is to keep up to date on your software updating, and also, you know, to have some good and up-to-date antivirus software.
All right, very good. Thanks so much for your time. Will, can you tell our listeners where they can find out more information about some of the services that the FTC has to offer along these lines?
Sure. If you go to ftc.gov, there's all sorts of information about consumer scams that we see online, telemarketing scams, you name it. There's advice there for consumers for how to deal with those things, and then also to report complaints to us if you think you've been victimized, that we use in our cases to try to go after the perpetrators of these frauds.
So they can actually report something that they've seen online.
That's right.
That's fantastic. Will, thanks very much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're out of time this week for DIY Cyber Guy. Remember to send your questions to me at questions@DIYCyberGuide.com. Also, our podcast is now live on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Overcast. We have a free ebook on the website at DIYCyberGuide.com/free. Again, DIYCyberGuide.com/free. If you want to download our free ebook, just go there and we'll get that right out to you. You can also buy my book, Digital Habits, at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Just search the term Digital Habits 5 and you'll find us right there on top. Also, you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook at DIYCyberGuide.com. Thank you for listening. And again, don't be afraid of the internet. Stay informed, be aware, and avoid the traps by listening to DIY Cyber Guy every week. Thank you for listening.
Anchor ID is a new way to log into websites and mobile apps, all without a password. The key is your smartphone, literally. Your smartphone is the key that will replace the need for passwords to your online sites. Our next product will be available to Salesforce.com users soon. To sign up for the first year free, just go to anchorid.com/Salesforce. Visit anchorid.com/Salesforce and get your first year free.
Looking for exciting video content live and on demand? Visit www.voiceamerica.tv for exclusive content you just can't find anywhere else. That's voiceamerica.tv. Tune in now.
You are You're listening to DIY Cyber Guy with David W. Schroffer. If you have a question for David, please send it to questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. That's questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back to DIY Cyber Guy. We're joined again by a guest that we've had on the show before. His name is Dr. Dale Myeros. He is a retired Major General at the U.S. Air Force, and he is the first President-appointed U.S. Senate-confirmed Chief Information Officer of the U.S. intelligence community, and we're happy to have him back on the show. Dr. Myeros, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Dave. Glad to be here.
Now, I understand you do a lot of consulting for big companies and small companies, and obviously you've had a career with the U.S. government, which we'll just call that a large organization, shall we? So how do you translate? I mean, are the messages the same for the organization that's got millions, literally millions of employees in it versus the organization that's got three or four employees to it?
Well, some of the messages are the same. The business about you all have potential threats that you need to guard against. You all need to do things. And again, one of my benchmark elements is security is what you do, not necessarily something you have or buy. So with that in mind, if you're a big, complex organization, you need large, complex things to address those. If you're a small or a medium size company, you don't need all of the bureaucratic processes and trappings, but you still need to address the same fundamental element that says that my company needs to operate properly in cyberspace so that I am protected, so that I limit my liabilities, and so that I'm good at what I do.
Okay, so you're saying that even at a massive organization, hundreds of thousands of employees, each one of those employees can't just show up to work and say, "We're a big company. I'm covered." The guys in the back room there that are keeping all those green lights lit on all those servers, they're going to keep me safe. There are things that an employee can do that can defeat all these things that the guys in the back room trying to keep you safe with all their computer tools and all their antivirus products, et cetera, that can all be defeated by actions of an individual.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I would venture to say, since the percentages are in the 90-plus percent, I would venture to say that every single major cyber breach that you read about in newspapers, magazines, here on the radio or TV or whatever, were all either instigated, caused, or abetted by insider behavior.
Now, and behavior doesn't necessarily need to be intentionally doing something bad, though. It can just be, are you talking about bad habits, or are you talking about somebody going to, a questionable content website in the middle of their workday?
The reason I use the term insider behavior is that typically in the cybersecurity business they call it insider threat. That immediately makes everybody think that it takes a bad employee or employee that's turned or whatever, and my employees aren't that way or whatever. But several of the things that you just mentioned are exactly how the path of least resistance of how evildoers penetrate. They're not going to get in through the firewall. They're not going to get in through the secure socket layers, the certificates, and things like that. They're after the identity of somebody that can, and then they operate as an authorized user behind all of those security fences. And there's a name for it, and so when you hear this name, you know that this is what we're talking about. It's called the Advanced Persistent Threat. Advanced Persistent Threat. And so that's what we're talking about. In fact, if you were to look across industries, the average time from which an evildoer gains access through an employee or a website or whatever is about 24 months before the company finds out that there's somebody unauthorized working from the inside.
24 months.
Yep. So how much information can they exfiltrate in 24 months?
So this is advanced persistent threat is really, it sounds like a polite or politically correct way of saying, I don't have an employee that's acting intentionally against my company. It's just an employee that made a mistake or didn't follow the habits or somehow let a bad guy in who's now acting with their identity to do bad things. So the threat's out there, but a good employee who otherwise is perfectly loyal and perfectly following the law let a bad guy in unintentionally.
Exactly. And it can be any employee. Now, there are such things as privileged users, and so a privileged user is somebody with all kinds of major accesses and such. Well, they've got to be more careful. You've probably heard about WannaCry and Spectre and some of these kinds of attacks and over the last few months.
We've talked a lot about every one of those on the show.
Yeah. You know, every one of those was caused because a company did not install its patches properly or promptly.
So, now, when you say patches, you mean upgrades to software. Something's broken, the software company fixes it, but it doesn't do anybody any good if you don't install the upgrade.
That's right. Install it and install it properly. And so it was all this horrible attacking and all those kinds of things. When in fact, every one of those were preventable. Had the folks who were responsible for either patches, upgrades, or initial installation of software done it properly, promptly. And so that was not intended to be malicious. It was careless.
One of the biggest hacks of all time was the Equifax hack, and that was the same case, was it not?
Exactly.
Computers hadn't been patched with a known problem that had a known fix that was published, and I want to say that the fix had been published for many, many multiple months before the bad guys even figured out that this ultra-sensitive information was running on computers that wasn't patched at all.
You're exactly right. In fact, as I recall the scenario, the vulnerability was discovered. It took like almost 2 months for the owners of the systems to get the next version out, tested, and ready and installed. And then it was a couple months after that, the evildoers in the world, poking around and spying and looking and collecting information, all of a sudden figured out, there are a whole bunch of these folks that haven't done this. Equifax happened to have been one of them for this particular thing. And then 4 months later, it got discovered after. So you can see how time marches on pretty quick. And so when you say that across industries, it takes weeks and months for something to be discovered, that's a good example of how that plays out.
So my listeners probably aren't the sysadmins at Equifax. They're more likely the sole proprietor of your favorite bakery in town or flower shop or even a small law office. So it sounds like what you're saying is for those people that want to do their jobs and run their business and not focus half their day on just keeping their computers working, it sounds like just the auto update function of their computers or their operating systems might be one of the better ways to stay ahead of this patch problem.
Absolutely. Although not necessarily always, Every single installation of an application in my company will have a slight variation than your company does. For instance, I may have different password management criteria than you have. That right there creates a difference. So I've got this saying. It's along the Pareto principle that says when you hear about cybersecurity and techniques and strategies and things like that, 80% of it can probably be applicable to you.
Mm-hmm.
But 20% of it is what is specifically applicable to you, and that's what really matters.
Specifically applicable to you, meaning anybody, any man, woman, or child using a computer anywhere?
No, meaning what your company does. So, you know, you've got a bake shop, or you've got a locksmith, or you've got, you're a small manufacturing company or whatever. Your configuration is probably not replicated anywhere else in the world. Exactly. Same number of computers. Right. You know, just the mere fact that you've got different employees than those other people mean that your employees act differently. Your employees manage their, you know, your information differently just because they're different employees than somebody else's. See, it's those nuances that are really important that you understand. You know, again, back to my statement that security is what you do. And so, mm-hmm. if you have the exact same network as another company, but you got different employees, your network's going to be different because you got different employees, and they're going to behave slightly different than the employees of another related company.
So it's just as important as a small business owner to make sure that your updates are running on all of the computers that are running in your system. But it sounds like the training and just the reinforcement and the awareness of things like phishing emails or visiting sites that you're not absolutely sure are the sites that are what they say they are. That training, that awareness, is as important as anything that they can do in the back room or with updates or with software.
Absolutely, and it has to be continuous. Okay, so we've got a, you know, we've got a small delivery service, and we change out the map function for making deliveries to a different map function. Well. Mm-hmm. Everybody uses that map function needs to know what the proper usage of that map function is. And so then say it gets upgraded and the upgrade, adds a feature or takes away a feature or whatever. Well, then everybody mm-hmm. who uses that needs to know that that feature is no longer available or that there's a new feature available that we want you to use because it saves us time on our deliveries.
So it sounds like it's really worth an investment of time periodically, every week or every month, to make some of these reminders to every last employee at a small company.
Exactly. And so I've got a practical approach, just a way to think about this. And the first is you have a strategy. Strategy is about choices. And you make deliberate, conscious choices that says we have a strategy to use technology to help us do these kinds of things. And it's not just information technology; it's other kinds of technology. For instance, it may not be information technology that controls the thermostat in your building or whatever, but it's a sensor technology, has applications associated with it. So you got to think about anything that has a processor in it. You're relying on technology to help you do functions. You need to analyze the functions that you do and see if there are any risks and then mitigate those risks to whatever degree. It's just like if you've got a front door and a back door to your shop, you're going to have a lock for each. And maybe the lock for the back door, because it's unguarded or whatever, you also put a security camera out there because it's right in an alley and there's people aren't walking by on the street. And so maybe that's how you mitigate the risk of somebody having concealed cover to gain access to the back of your shop. Same thing for cyber.
So you're talking about what's commonly known as Internet of Things and basically saying, I think most people recognize that security is not a front and center concern when these companies are building various Internet of Things devices, everything from light bulbs to remote control cars, anything that can basically, like you said, has a chip in it, it can connect to a network. So that's the weak link. That's the way that the bad guys can get into your network, or what do they do with that access point?
Okay, so it depends what they're after from you. For instance, they may be after, do you have client information stored? And so mm-hmm. they'll gain access through an easy means and then hunt around and try and gain access to your client database, in which that you have client names and addresses and maybe telephone numbers and email addresses and all kind of identifying information that gives them access to maybe your 500 customers or your 50 customers or your 1,000 customers or however big your clientele is.
This is sort of an analog to what you were saying before, that when an attacker gets into a large company, they can be there for months and months and months without anybody ever knowing it. So basically the same thing with a small business or even a home computer. The bad guy can be in there just looking around, running programs, pulling in as much information as they can for month after month. Is that about the case?
Yes, that is the case. And again, there are ways in which you can mitigate those things. Let me give you a good example that I help a lot of small companies do. Okay, so you run a delivery store or you run a bakery, you run some sort of small town business operation.
Yeah.
And people pay you with credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so up till 2 or 3 years ago, you would have to store and protect all the credit card information and all of those kinds of things within your own network so that you could service, so that you could get invoice, so that you could get paid, so that you could do all those things.
Right.
And so now there's invoicing as a service. And so small to medium companies can go to organizations that specialize in it and, in fact, open an account so that when your clients and your customers use their credit card, none of their information is stored in your company's network. It is stored in the network of the transaction organization, and they just make sure that the money moves in and out of your accounts.
So even though you're swiping a credit card or using a chip and PIN, they're on the premises of your bakery, flower shop, what have you, the information is actually not stored there anymore. It's stored somewhere on the cloud?
That's right. Or a manager or some hosting component or in fact, some financial institutions run such a service for companies who are registered with them and things like that. And so right there that you've decreased your liability and your risk exposure and you don't do it at the expense or the inconvenience of your clients. They still want to pay by credit card, they still want to process a check, or they still want to do this. And you have enough identifying information of the client that you know one client from another, you know one address from another, but you don't have any of their personally identifiable information, which is a lot of what the evildoers are after. And so that's a way in which you can mitigate your liability and cyber risk, giving evildoers a lot less targets to go after, so to speak.
So I'm imagining right now that we've got a few listeners listening to what you're saying, and they're thinking, okay, I've got an antique shop, I process credit cards, I've got a few Internet of Things devices, maybe little security cameras in the back, or a couple little doohickeys that I've collected that I use in the shop. So now I've got Internet of Things access points. I take credit cards, and I imagine that some of them are thinking, I've got no idea whether or not I'm storing this credit card information locally in the computer in the back room, or if it's being stored in the cloud. So what question should that shop owner ask their credit card service provider or the company that provides the swiping devices or what have you? What question should they ask specifically that will tell them whether or not that information, that sensitive information, is being stored on their computer, giving them the liability or not the liability, but
the exposure.
No, the liability. The exposure.
Yeah, it's the exposure.
Or versus it being stored properly on the cloud, like you just said. What should they ask their service providers?
Okay. First of all, they probably signed a contract. That contract is between 6 to 10 pages long, and in that contract, it will state where certain information and what type of information is stored where and how and what access is given to it by entity. So if you already have a service like that, then you need to pull that contract out and do a little highlight area to make sure that you understand what your exposure is. If you don't have that service, shop around, you know, get two or three comparisons and say, this is what I want to have happen. I don't want to store any customer personally identifiable information here. I don't want to do this, or I do want to do that. And they'll say, okay, that'll cost you this much. Well, okay, now what if I take that away? Well, this will cost you another amount. And what if I, you know, and so in essence, you lay out what architecture you want your company to have, and each one of them comes with a different price. And so the more things that you have outsourced, obviously, the higher your contract element. But that's something that you weigh against the risk and exposure that you want or are willing to have. For instance, let's say I'm a distributor, a hardware store distributor. And so, like, the inventory I've got and things like that, that can be stored at your regional hardware store distributor, not at your local. And then you download, certain elements which, you know, keep track of your inventory, give you new prices, all of those kinds of things. That, you know, some people call that a containerization or a segmentation. Right. And so when you segment, you know, what your ecosystem is, and don't think of it as a network, think of it as your ecosystem, which encompasses your people, your people to computer interface, your computer to computer interfaces, your computer to your vendor, your customer, and things like that. Think of it that way. Think of it as an ecosystem. And the more that you can segment critical parts of it, the harder you make it for if somebody, you know, gains access, they can't horizontally go behind your firewall and find everything.
Perfect. So really what you're saying is you got to shop around, find what you want. And for those of you who are out there running a small business, just play this for the service provider that's providing your credit cards. Play this episode back to them, and you make sure you get exactly what you need. So Dr. Myros, absolutely fantastic advice. Where can people find out more about your work?
Sure. I run a consulting company known as the Myros Group at www.myros.com, and that's spelled MEYERROSE. And of course, if you put me in a browser, in all likelihood, you'll find my Wikipedia page come up, which really impresses my daughters that Dad really made it, because he's got a Wikipedia page because at one time I was a public figure.
Outstanding. Well, thank you for your service, Dr. Myros, and thanks again for being on the show.
You bet. Enjoyed it. Have a great day.
Okay, thank you, and we will be right back with DIY Cyber Guy.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Get the news on our shows and other happenings by following us on Twitter. Find us at VoiceAmericaTRN or Twitter.com/VoiceAmericaTRN.
Anchor ID is a new way to log into websites and mobile apps, all without a password. The key is your smartphone, literally. Your smartphone is the key that will replace the need for passwords to your online sites. Our next product will be available to Salesforce.com users soon. To sign up for the first year free, just go to anchorid.com/Salesforce. Visit anchorid.com/Salesforce and get your first year free. You are listening to DIY Cyber Guy with David W. Schroefer. If you have a question for David, please send it to questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. That's questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back to DIY Cyber Guy. We have time for one more listener question, and here it is. This is from Mike in New York, who asks, I am an angel investor thinking about investing in a startup with an innovative way to mine Bitcoin. I'm not looking for investment advice, but I would like to understand the technology better. I heard that Bitcoin mining is so inefficient that eventually the electric bill will be greater than the income for a Bitcoin miner. Is that possibly true? And I am glad you're not looking for investment advice, Mike. That's not what we do here. But I can tell you something about the technology. So the sentence is missing a few words, and that is, if nothing changes, that would actually be true. If nothing changes in the production of electricity or the power of computer processing, then yeah, the electric bill for anybody around the world will eventually, and I'm talking years and years and years and years in the future, nobody knows exactly how long, but eventually that would be true. The electric bill would be higher than the income of a miner. But that relies on the idea that nothing's going to change in electricity production and nothing's going to change in computer processing. So this is really a hair on fire 1 out of 5. This is important, but not urgent. If you hold Bitcoin or you know anybody that holds Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency for that matter, this is something to pay attention to and really understand because it goes to the heart of the value of these cryptocurrencies. So again, as we've talked about before, Bitcoin runs on a ledger. That ledger is a blockchain ledger. All it has is credits and debits. But importantly, there are no account balances on it. It just keeps a track. Just keeps track of which account made the transaction, what is the credit amount, or what is the debit amount. So to complete any transaction, if you want to use your Bitcoin to buy something, Bitcoin first has to figure out, or the ledger first has to figure out, do you have any Bitcoin to spend? So to do that, it needs to look all the way back to the first transaction of your track of Bitcoin and figure out exactly how many credits and how many debits have happened on your account over time to make sure that that's a positive balance, so you have something to spend. So the math problem required to calculate all of that and to find the hash for the Bitcoin itself takes a lot of electricity and a lot of computer power. Originally, the sum of all of those credits and debits was just a few megabytes in size. It wasn't very big, didn't have a lot of math to do. But now it's getting big, really big, because every transaction that have happened over time since the beginning of Bitcoin are all stored in this one blockchain that's distributed all over the world to about 150,000 different nodes roughly around the world. So it's really big. So how big is it? Right now it's about 149 gigabytes. That's a big math problem to solve for any computer to solve. And it takes computing power and it takes time to do that. And if you want to keep track of how big the Bitcoin blockchain is, I have a link in the show notes from Statistica.com that keeps track of that over time. So at 149 gigabytes, that's so big that the cost of electricity is already becoming a real constraint. So this is really not something you can do in your house. If you want to live in the United States, your electric bill at your home is probably going to be higher to run the computers to mine Bitcoin competitively and get paid. You only get paid if you are able to crack a block of transactions first before anybody else in the world does. And that gets harder and harder to do the more your computers use electricity. So your electric bill will go up more than the value that you earn from that activity in most places in the US, unless you have some sort of a leg up. So yeah, it's true. If this keeps up, the blockchain just gets bigger and bigger with more and more transactions added to it. And either electricity gets a lot cheaper for everybody or computing power gets a lot faster for everybody. And nobody knows how long it's going to take for one to overtake the other to make Bitcoin mining untenable, unprofitable for the miner. But again, that's if nothing changes. So either we find new ways to produce electricity and that takes a quantum leap forward, which I certainly hope, but I don't see that on the horizon, or computing power could change. Now that's a different story altogether because there is a thing out there called quantum computing and it's actually getting real and it could change everything when it comes to Bitcoin mining and cryptocurrency mining. So let's talk about quantum computing for a second. So a normal computer does things one at a time, serial processing. That's what they do. They do one command, then the next, then the next. If you ask a normal computer to count a billion items, it's going to count the first one, then the second one, all the way up to a billion, one at a time. That's what they do. That's how they're designed. In the world of quantum computing, just imagine this for a second. What where a normal computer would need a billion steps, at least, to count a billion items, a quantum computer requires one step to count a billion items. Now, practically speaking, that would require a quantum computer that has billions or even tens of billions of its smallest component. Its smallest component is called a quantum bit or a qubit, which is basically an electron spinning in a very tiny pool. It's remarkably cool stuff, and I've got links in the show notes that tell you a lot about that. But that's basically what we're talking about, a quantum computer with billions or tens of billions of these qubits spinning in these tiny little pools within a quantum computer to do the example that I just described, a billion, counting a billion things all at the same time. So that's great, but do quantum computers already exist? Well, sort of. So the biggest quantum computer on Earth a week ago was 2 qubits, not 2 million, not 200, 2 of these qubits spinning in this tiny little chip, which has to be kept extremely cold, by the way. I think it's 0.2 degrees Kelvin, which is pretty close to the point that all molecular motion stops. That's truly, truly cold, and it's hard to maintain. So the electrical consumption of all this is going to be a question that's going to linger out there. So a week ago, the biggest quantum computer was 2 qubits. This week, Intel announced a 5-qubit programmable quantum computer. That's actually really big news. I mean, when was the last time the size of the biggest computer in the world running on a particular technology more than doubled in size from 1 week to the next? That's a big jump forward. But practically going from a five-qubit quantum computer to a quantum computer with tens of billions of qubits is daunting. And it's going to take a while. But it works, and that's important to note. So if you want a great primer on quantum computing, I've got a link in the show notes from Intel, ironically, but they're really leading the way in a lot of ways in this in quantum computing going forward. But if you want to take a nice hard look at it, it's fascinating material in there. So we can't predict how much electricity these new quantum computers are going to need, but we do know that quantum computing changes everything when it comes to how computers work and how fast they work. Will they be 1,000 times faster, a billion times faster? It's hard to predict. But what we do know that fundamentally is they don't do things one at a time, or they don't have to do things one at a time. They can do billions of transactions or commands simultaneously, all at the same time, which could, like I said, change everything. These honestly could end up being tens of thousands or even millions or billions of times faster than traditional computers as soon as they get big enough to do that kind of processing. So the bottom line, computer processing power and the electricity that runs computers is the primary limitation of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. Computing processing power may take an unprecedented step forward over the next few years. And I mean few, you know, 2, 3, 4 years forward, and we could be looking at functioning, marketable quantum computers. So we don't know how much electricity that will take and whether or not that the electricity equation is going to remarkably change, but it really looks like the computing power is going to change and change very, very quickly as these computers get bigger and we go from 2 qubits, from 5 qubits to tens of billions of qubits. It'll take some time, but we're on the way. So quantum computing may allow Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies to exist very efficiently far, far, far into the future. And that's why Bitcoin's not going to go anywhere anytime soon, in my opinion. So predicting Bitcoin's death is really a bit premature at this stage. That's all the time we have. Remember, we've got a free ebook. I'm giving away the entire book, Digital Habits, until March 15th, not just a chapter, but every chapter of the book, including the portions at the beginning and the end, the introduction, the glossary thing. All if you just go to diycyberguy.com/free. Again, that's diy.com/free. To get the entire ebook. And remember to send your questions to questions@diycyberguy.com. You can download our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Player.fm, which is new this week, Stitcher, Overcast, whatever podcatcher you use, download our netcast and listen to it every week. So thank you for listening. And remember, as my guest, Dr. Myra Rose said, cybersecurity is something you do, not something you buy. I hope this episode helped you see how easy it is to do. So stay informed, be aware, and avoid the many traps on the internet by listening to DIY Cyber Guy every week. Thanks for listening.
Thank
Thank you for listening to DIY Cyber Guy. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this broadcast are for general information only, and we have not knowingly divulged any information that would conflict with any of our non-disclosure or confidentiality agreements. Please join your host, David W. Schroffer, next Thursday at 3 p.m. Pacific Time and 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Enjoy the Internet safely.